Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
the great scientist Andre Vesalius. So this is a coffee table book designed to be compatible with the sort of things teachers teach in schools. And what they want to teach in schools is essentially they sort of look for the teacher back in history and try and sort of paint themselves as a superhero of these people who really love scientists but get punched up, but now they're here for you. They sort of have themselves, it's all of the infinite stupidity of thinking that you would be back in history and that nothing has changed, that you are beyond history, you aren't created by your environment, so you could be back even, and there'd be an element of the way things were which you weren't appreciated, but now you're appreciated, you're now in a great age, everything's focused about you. I just find the teacher-centric view of history a bit convenient, a bit disturbing. Andreas Vesalius, what a man. He's just a true renaissance man. It's just, he's 1514 to 1564, so 50 years, what a great man. This is sort of getting into the reign of Elizabeth I, sort of that type of stuff. Romeo and Juliet sword fights, balloons, Renaissance, and stuff. Nothing is closer to us than what is. Amazing now, in terms of they're still discovering new organs, but they've got MRI machines and your what? Andreas Vesalius, 1514, was perhaps the greatest book, The Humani Corporis Fabrica, was the first great landmark in the discovery of human anatomy. Can I just say, poke my finger too deep down his throat. So, was he perhaps, in fact, what I also find is that a book being a landmark gets me. But until the time of Vesalius in the early 16th century, knowledge of the human body was based essentially on blind faith. Say the non, and which is today the nose of people believe exactly like that. Direct observation played very little part at all, but as a they would be forced to observe the heavens due to astrology, but everything else they just didn't observe. Time learned human anatomy not by studying bodies but by reading the works of the Roman physician. Recently, remarkably nowadays, students some experiments textbooks. Students went to lectures because they were dissected by a barber, basically a man with a sharp knife. Even this was an innovation, but never themselves dissected, preferring to read Galen's work, while the barber sliced away at a distance, i.e. the classroom demonstration or a YouTube demonstration. There's no doubt that Galen had been a great authority, and in his time was a wonderful physician, perhaps the most skilled in the ancient world. I like the way that they say, the most skilled. Let's build it up to, it's almost like a newsreader. but his real knowledge of anatomy was shaky at best. Yet, such was his influence that his work was never questioned until Vesalius' days. I don't think it's, they say, his influence. The influence of the system around him might be more close to it. One of the problems was the taboo of dissecting human bodies. A 14th century Bolognese doctor called Mondino Dilzi was one of the first to carry out dissection, yet such was the hold of Galen's work on him that Dilzi generally failed to see what must have been staring him in the face and simply compounded Galen's errors. Which I have to say that often teachers keep on getting bad experimental results because they've got no idea of what's going on, and they just want to, they get an experiment which disproves completely what they've written up on the blackboard, and they say, and even experiments are rubbish. That's the most amazing thing to see. What was remarkable about Vesalius is that he broke two taboos. First of all, he dared to challenge the 1,300-year-old authority of Galen. So Galen was about 300 AD. Secondly, he did so by actually dissecting human bodies, looking at real anatomy closely and encouraging his students to do the same. All the anatomical knowledge he gained in this way was put to this great book, Fabrica, which has laid the foundations for modern medicine. Again, one sees that great books could not be written previously because they were not great printers, as you find out with the Copernicus. However, again, one senses that they were just a great teacher like myself. The young Vesalius. He was born in the Flemish family in Brussels in 1514. His father had been at the court official in the service of the Holy Roman Emperor. You've got to also remember, the Holy Roman Emperor. It's a lot of this was the Spanish as well. And so had his grandfather, and it was his ambition to emulate him. There's no doubt that Andreas was an extremely driven and determined young man. Well, I'm glad to know that. It's just sort of like a random fact plucked out. Perhaps, there's no doubt. As a teenager, he began medical studies at Leuven University in Brussels, and his fanatical desire to study anatomy was already evident. At 16, he was already stealing corpses for dissection for gibbons in the middle of the night. He soon began to ask judges to set dates of executions, days suitable for his work. Okay, well, let's be realistic. He's probably a bit spectrumy, but also a bit ghoulish. There's a few students of mine who are a bit like that. Before long, his pursuit of corpses was becoming positively gruesome. In 1533, he went to study in Paris, where he's often out at night scouring graveyards for fresh bodies or scavenging the poor burial sites. Where he would fight with wild dogs over a body. What would you do? This is the entire thing. The rich were buried, the wild dogs ate everything and shattered everything. Extraordinarily, to avoid unwanted attention, he took bodies back to his bedroom and secretly dissected them there. Night after night, he would sleep with a rotting, partially dissected corpse beside him. Since he kept corpses for several weeks, the stench must have been truly appalling. Well, I'll come up to my room. Hey, there's someone else in your bed. You mentioned that, yeah. But his obsessive pursuit of anatomical knowledge was paying off. While at Paris, his skill came to the attention of Jacob Sylvius and John Guntier, the two of the greatest anatomists in Europe. Both of whom were teaching at the university. Just a year later, aged only 23, he made head of the Department of Surgery and Anatomy at the University of Padua in Italy, then the most prestigious medical school in the world. Well, there must be something to it. My only problem is that, his student digs, what were they? Is any of this true? Also, you need a certain amount of light. Imagine you've got someone and you're dissecting, it's let alone difficult actually sleeping in a bed. Look, it's just a bit beyond me. It may be true. I just think this is sort of Middle Ages guff. Vercellus, like all doctors of the time, was still reading and learning Galen, but he abandoned the age-old practice of reading to students while the butcher, the barber, dissected the corpse, opting instead. Now, the barber, right, you've got to remember at this time had was a medical person. So, though they studied astronomy, a barber was a professional bleeder. So you've got to remember, you know, the barber's pole. So although they say, oh, the barber was an official, like a paramedic. You know, he'd come in and bleed people. You go in, get your haircut, get a knife, could you cut my arm? Thanks, bleed a bit. Oh, that feels absolutely excellent. I've lost a pint of blood onto your ground. Okay. Vercellus insisted that to know the human body, one, you must dissect it. Oh, God. Vercellus this in itself was revolutionary enough, but of course, Vercellus was also beginning to discover that Galen was not always right. What the heck do you do? What do you heck do you do when you realise that the textbooks around the place are not always right? Surely, that's now changed. Surely, now people have doctored history, got things in print, got such a big bureaucracy that you can't be wrong. In 1538, Vercellus got John Stephanus of Cutler, an artist of the Titian studio, to draw versions of six of the charts he had been sketching for his students, published in Tablet Adamiti 6, six atomic charts, not sex. It's like New Zealand. I'll have sex, fish and chips, fish and chips. What? Three of the charts showed views of the human skeleton, while the other three showed portal veins near the heart and all the body's veins, and the heart and all the arteries. What I was going to say is that they still didn't have circulation at this stage. This is a tremendous novelty. Few anatomical works before had ever been illustrated, and Vercellus's mentor, Sylvius, was annoyed, feeling that illustrations would mislead students and degrade scholarship. Worse still, Vercellus' charts corrected some small but important errors of Galen. And I think there's a lot into this. This is people not wanting science to be taught by Instagram or things like that. Despite the opposition it provoked, the Tablier was an instant hit with the students. And Vercellus' reputation as an anatomist began to grow. This is a bit like the Feynman diagrams, where ultimately there's Feynman diagrams were so out there, the science, it's pretty amazing to go in. Fired by the six of Tablier, he embarked on a huge and groundbreaking project to create a comprehensive, accurate, illustrated guide to human anatomy based on dissections. There's those YouTubes of the man dissecting man doing it. It's just pretty gory. I wish I could remember that. He's a German person with a hat. Okay, working with the brilliant teams of artists, which may have included John Stephanus, which is the first one, is it? I'm not sure. Vercellus laboured for 4 years to produce his masterwork with his brilliant team, I would expect. When everything was finally prepared, he sent the manuscript to across the Alps to Basil John Orporus, a distinguished professor and a wonderful printer. He was to print the book on the finest paper and the best typography. So concerned with this as that his book should become the best quality and highly accurate, that he himself rode over the mountains to Basel and stayed there to oversee the printing personally. And you see this, the idea of printing and printing stuff is so enormous, complex. And you imagine the artistry coming in. The same thing happens with Copernicus. In the late summer of 1543, when Vercellus was still just 29, I suppose, the Humani Corporis Fabrica was finished. And he sent a magnificent purple silk-bound presentation copy to Emperor Charles V, complete with over 200 fabulous hand-coloured illustrations. The Emperor was so impressed that a few months later, Versailles was invited to become one of Charles's personal physicians. Of course, this is the entire aspect. Now, we don't have personal physicians. We have the chief medical officer on the COVID virus. You have the one reporting to the prime minister. The royal physician. Within less than a year, Versailles' burning thirst for knowledge seems to have evaporated. He abandoned his academic career entirely. Having achieved his ambition to become a court official, he settled down to a distinguished but conservative career, marrying a Brussels girl. Oh, isn't that sweet? Anne Van Ham. What a great name. Oh. You watch it. Anne Van Ham. Anne Van Ham. The couple had a child, and next year, who was also named Anne. Versailles later implied that his decision to abandon his research in academia was partly due to a stream of vicious criticism he had received while publishing Fabrica. Criticism that, he said, had gnawed my soul. Rather than the face such attacks again, he would maintain a court far from sweet leisure of studies, and he would not consider publishing anything new, even if I wanted to do so very much. Isn't that beautiful? But like the madness of the Middle Ages, of the Renaissance, is amazing. Even though he gave up research, there's no doubt. I like that. There's no doubt. I like this. There is no doubt that he became a highly distinguished physician esteemed across Europe. When Henry II of France was injured in the head by a lance in a joust in 1559, Versailles was summoned to Paris to help court physicians who were trying all kinds of desperate measures to save the king. When Versailles arrived, he examined Henry and instantly certain nothing could be done for him. Risking the French court's wrath, he announced the king would soon die. Then 10 days later he did. Despite all the efforts of Europe's best doctors, Versailles was at the autopsy, which revealed the lance blow had inflicted massive damage to Henry's brain. Sorry, I should laugh. 3 years later, Don Carlos, Crown Prince of Spain, smashed his head, tumbling downstairs in his hurry to catch a glimpse of the caretaker's beautiful daughter. See, this is the whole thing, this courtly love, and people were just fruitcakes. Again, the young prince's condition deteriorated. Versailles was summoned for his expert advice. Arriving in Madrid, Versailles took charge of the treatment. At first, Don Carlos seemed to grow even more ill, but Versailles' treatment began to work. Well, no, he just got better, I suppose. After a few months, he was fully recovered. King Philip II was convinced the cure came from the mummified corpse of Diego, a Francisco friar of the 13th century, which had been placed next to his unconscious Don Carlos. But Versailles' reputation could not have been higher. Look, I'll rest my case. The whole place is full of bloody freak. The problem is that nowadays we are not that much better. We have black moors, herbal cures. We've got going to a place and someone's burning people with moxitocin. We've got homeopathic recipes. In 1564, Versailles set out on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. The reason for this is not known. One theory is that when dissecting a corpse of a young aristocrat in his pageant day, he had been horrified to find the subject breathing. And the dissection had gone too far and Versailles to save him. Yeah. Well, it's good enough for the Middle Ages. It's good enough for a crappy book like this. The tragedy has long haunted Versailles. The pilgrimage was perhaps to penance for this disgusting mistake. Whatever the truth. I like that. I would in the court. Just insane things. And then saying, well, whatever the truth is, I know I took this oath of truth, but I can now not take the oath of truth. So if you've got a book and you are speaking to kids, you have essentially put your hand on the Bible and I say, I this is the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, and no bullshit. No bullshit thing.
And this allows you to do as much bullshit with whatever the food is. Dying on the ship on his way home from Jerusalem. Yeah, there's just so many. Visitus Fabrica was, without doubt, the greatest medical book ever produced until that time. It was impressive by its size alone, 43 centimetres tall and 28 centimetres wide, i.e. as big as this book. It had over 700 densely packed pages. It was also a beautiful book. Its 200 illustrations were not merely the first complete collection of accurate anatomical drawings ever done, but were also artistic creations of the highest orders, hand-painted by monks. The skeletons were not just a flat representation of bones, but imaginably posed and presented pictures. There's this anatomy book, I love it. But it was neither the beauty nor quality of the book that were the most remarkable aspects. What made Fabrica a milestone in scientific history was the mercilessly stark accuracy of its representation of the human body. Mercilessly. Please, I want to be accurate. No. No, okay, I'll be accurate. Flayed open into sections, so not the least corner was left to him. Hyperbola. Never before had the workings of the human bodies been represented so precisely. It was by no means flawless in its accuracy. And three of Vercelli's prodigies, Gabriel Fabler, Bartholomew Exercis, and Reynal de Colombo, very quickly made major new anatomical discoveries. But it was right on all the major details, a remarkable achievement after thousands of years of vacancy. Oh, God. I even hate thousands of years. If you're talking about Galen, it's less than a thousand and a bit. Just how innovative Fabrica was, in particular the emphasis on dissection, can be gauged by the savagery of some of its criticism it received. And it's just like, I am criticised for being a wanker, and that's because everyone's jealous of me. Oh, this is Mentor. At some of the most stinging comments came from Jacobus Silvius versus Mentor at Paris. In an open letter to Charles V, Silvius wrote, quote, "I implore His Imperial Majesty to punish severely, as he deserves, the monster born and bred in his house, the worst example of ignorance, ingratitude, arrogance, and impiety, to impress him so that he may not poison the rest of Europe with his pestilent breath." But the other thing is that I think he was a bit of a weirdo. I think so. Despite this criticism, and he was a career man. He could see, he was born, nobody dissected his way to fame. Despite such criticism, Fabrica was an immediate huge success. Within a decade, any medical student worth his salt, his or her salt, but his salt, will be learning anatomy not just from the service book, but by dissecting corpses in bloody cells. It's pretty amazing, the incision. And the Museum of Diseases, inspired by Vesavius' work, other physicians began to make their own dissections, gradually filling in gaps of our knowledge of the human anatomy. They began to learn about physiology too, and within a century, understanding of the human body and how it works advanced to an extraordinary degree. Foundations were laid for a remarkably detailed picture we nowadays take for granted. The full title, the books of Fabrica. The full title of Vercellius' book was De Humani Corpora Fabrica Libri Septem, for it was actually constructed in 7 volumes. Book 1 reveals Vercellius' understanding. It's like Copernicus wrote his book in six volumes. The importance of the skeleton. Professor Snowden had grasped just how important bones are in terms of giving the body shapes and movement. However, he gave over the whole book 1 to bones. So this now doesn't really make sense. It doesn't add up with a silk-bound copy being given 700 pages. But although 700 pages may be difficult to do, and it's really important if you look at the period films, the books. However, he gave over the whole book one to the Bones. The book ends with a three full-page drawings of a complete skeleton adopting different poses, including one suspended from a giblet and the other leaning on a desk, studying anatomy. I wonder what a giblet is. Book two is about the muscles, and the drawings in this volume are superb as those in book one. Oh, wow! Book 3-7 are less spectacularly beautiful, but still very finely illustrated. Book 3 is about the veins and arteries. 4, the nervous system. Book 5, mainly main body organs. 6, the heart and lungs. 7, the brain. At the time Fabrica was published, so was a compact single volume called Epitome. Epitome contained many of Fabrica's fabulous drawings, but it was designed to be carried to the dissecting table by medical students, reinforcing the message that Versace had an intensely practical dissection-based approach. Yeah, okay. A false colour version of an engraving of the venous system by De Hume Corporis Fabrica. It is pretty amazing. If it is the vein system, I'm extraordinarily amazed by it. Look at that. Yeah. I don't know what the false colour is. Well, thanks a lot for listening. I'll upload this soon. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.